greetings. This is Joe Farinaccio from OutRigMedia.com, and I have Jim Brown on the phone. Hello, Jim.
Hi there, Joe.
Well, Jim, you're getting ready to go on a trip, and you didn't have time. You had some computer problems with regards to making this week's podcast. So we're going to do an impromptu interview here, but it concerns one of our favorite topics and subjects, one Mr. Tim Mann, and I'm looking forward to hearing the story.
Well, Tim Mann has given us a wonderful biographical interview years ago that a couple years ago that's now available in our Conversations series by subscription. But I had a chance to catch up with him this week on the phone. He was speaking on a cell phone from Hawaii, and I tried to record our conversation without success. Also, I had trouble with my own microphone. So I'm going to just tell you, Joe, about Tim Mann. I'll recap his history a little bit.
Yes.
And then tell you what's going on now and try to explain how that fits together with everything else that's going on in the caper casting biz right now.
Yeah, that's great, Jim. I'm very interested in hearing about Tim. He's one of the most fascinating guys I've ever spoken to myself. Yeah, so please tell us about Tim and what's happening today.
Well, going back in the mid-1960s, I met this guy as a young man. He was right out of high school and trying to decide what he was going to do with his life, and he realized that the greatest avenue toward freedom was to have his own cruising sailboat. Well, he was 16 years old, and he managed to convince his father that he could build himself a seagoing sailboat, and one of their neighbors loaned him their driveway and actually were instrumental in his completing his 25-foot Sea Runner in about a year's time. And he took off in that thing and, you know, really barnstormed up and down the western seaboard of California and sort of wore it out. And at one point he was in harbor at Santa Barbara, California, and saw over the fence into some yard a 37-foot Sea Runner that was partly built. Well, he managed to acquire that thing and finished it up and took off across the Pacific. He made some tremendous voyages out to Hawaii and then down to the Marshall Islands, where he ended up in the boat business, building boats for the government, fishing boats. And in his cruising, he began to realize that the opportunity to sustain himself from on board by catching fish and using the fish for trading items with the natives or selling it outright to the natives was a great opportunity. He had the ability to go way offshore and get real pelagic fish, and because the artisanal fishing fleet worldwide is in such deplorable condition, the fish that he was able to provide were valuable on shore. And so he did that for a while, but then ended up in the Marshall Islands, as I mentioned, building motorboats for the government, and began to realize at that point what a good idea it was to try to design a sailing fishing boat, a boat that was intended for fishing, which the Sea Runners were not. Well, that eventually led to his settling in Hawaii, where he built the 57-foot trimaran he named Tropic Bird. And Tropic Bird had a 5-ton fish hold in the main cabin, you know, where you'd normally have your main accommodation in a 57-foot trimaran. Incidentally, he designed it and built it himself in a year about. And he began to sail from Hawaii out to distant sea mounts, that is, underwater islands that came close enough to the surface for them to become a fish aggregator. And he was able to sail out to these distant sea mounts and either catch fish or not catch fish and still come back to Hawaii without having expended himself on fuel. He realized that the sailing aspect made it possible for him to fail. The boat was able to fail, which so many of the local motorized fishing boats were not able to do. If they put on a couple of tons of ice and a couple of tons of fuel and went out for a couple of weeks and came back pretty much empty-handed, they were out of business.
And yeah, so the sailing gave him an edge. The sailing gave him an edge, yeah.
And so he discovered that a lot of the commercial boats were just sitting idle because of the cost of fuel. Then he and his wife, Suzanne, realized that living in Hawaii, they were pretty much at the end of the supply chain. Hawaii apparently has to import 92% of its food or some such, and he became interested in trying to stimulate the local people to grow their own food again, and he figured that the way to do it was with what they call aquaponics. The land that Tim and Suzanne have there on the west side of the Big Island, I guess it was formerly pineapple land. It has a gentle slope to it, and so they were able to, using gravity feed, put in a fish pond, and the water from that fish pond, being heavy with nutrients from the fish, was allowed to pass slowly through beds of a certain description built in tanks that Tim designed. Anyway, what he did was vastly simplify the process of aquaponics compared to the way it had been normally done, that was quite energy intensive. Tim got it simplified, and because he was a boat builder, he was able to build all of the stuff out of plywood and epoxy that he needed in order to eventually become a world authority in the subject of aquaponics. You know about that, Joe?
Yes, yes.
And so for years now, he and Suzanne have been traveling all over the world giving classes and selling books and getting people into aquaponics, but all during this time, he's had a hankering to get back out on the water. So he and Suzanne have built a big boat shop on their land. I mean, it's a rather lofty building, and they have really spent themselves down buying equipment with which to go into a serious constant camber panel making operation. They have a sawmill and a bandsaw for ripping up blocks of timber, and then a big bandsaw for ripping out what we call board veneers. And they have other rather massive equipment, a big shaper and a boom truck. And it turns out that the people who run arbor services on the island there are always trying to get rid of trees. People call them up and say, hey, I got one that's ready to fall in my house. And because Tim has this boom truck, he can go and pick up logs for free of Hawaiian tropical hardwood, bring them back, run them through his sawmill, then run them through his bandsaw, and produce the materials for laminating constant camber panels. I'm not going to go into detail on constant camber. I've spoken of it before, and it's been pretty well covered in Wooden Boat Magazine and so on, but it's a streamlined method of building so-called cold-molded boats, laminated wood epoxy boats. And it's been around for a long time now. The patent has long since run out, but it's still in use in several places in the world, including not far from where I live here, Joe. Our old friend Doug Jane has just started in on his eighth catamaran, a big charter catamaran excursion boats for taking tourists for joyrides. And these boats are in service all over the world in the warm water resort areas. And John Mopples and I have over 30 of them operating now, but Doug has built eight of them. This is his eighth that he's working on now. So the constant camber boat building method has been well proven over time. And the best evidence of its lasting durability comes from the Coast Guard. These vessels all have to be certified for carrying passengers for hire. And many of our boats are operating in the Pacific, particularly in Hawaii, where they have to be certified for carrying passengers on offshore routes, which is a rather elevated approval from the Coast Guard. And the constant camber boats have a very good reputation for durability. And so this applies to what Tim now wants to do for the Hawaiian fishery that has a Hawaiian name, which I didn't really catch, but what it means is fishing for yellowfin tuna with squid. And that's done a lot around the islands. The fishing boats that go for this catch have quite a ways to go. They have to invest quite a bit in ice and fuel in order to participate in that fishery. And it's been vital until recently. There is a change. There are now apparently a lot of boats standing idle, again, because the guys cannot afford to fail. Mm-hmm. So Tim wants to introduce a sailing fish boat for that fishery in Hawaii, and he's chosen for the boat a 37-foot proa. Here we go now. We've got to get into the whole proa subject, and I'm going to be brief about it, but a proa is a single outrigger canoe, essentially, that is arranged so as to take the wind always over the single outrigger side. It doesn't tack to receive the wind from both sides of the vessel. It has to shunt instead and put its other end forward. And in that way, it can zigzag its way up to windward just as well, or in cases even better than traditional boats, but they're very different relative to the bilateral sailboats that we're accustomed to that tack their way to windward. The proa shunts its way to windward by sailing either end first. It has a bow on both ends. Well, the advantage to a boat like this, there's a lot to be said about the proa, and we can't get into the whole thing, but my son Russell has probably investigated the type as much as anyone in the world, certainly any American. He's done a lot of seafaring in his 37-foot Kauri, and the thing that has made the boat acceptable for offshore service is the so-called pod. It's a big protuberance that sticks out on the downwind side of the proa. Try to visualize the upwind side being the outrigger side, and the downwind side being the side away from the wind, and if the boat is operated properly, that side is never exposed to the wind. It's always downwind. But this pod is a large, very streamlined chamber that's located rather high on the boat. It's part of the superstructure. And in Russell's Cowrie, that space was used for the double bunk. So if you can imagine a 37-foot boat with a streamlined protuberance on the downwind side that's big enough for two people to sleep in, and you can almost sit up in your bunk in there. That's the proa, and the purpose, that's the modern proa, and the purpose of that pod is to act as buoyancy in the case, in the event that the boat gets knocked down by the wind. That is, if the wind blows hard enough in a gust to pick up the float on the upwind side, that tries to submerge the pod on the downwind side. That is, as the float goes way up in the air, let's say, even all the way up to a vertical position with the boat knocked down with the mast in the water, the buoyancy in that pod chamber is sufficient to cause the boat to rewrite itself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not something that Russell experimented with by the numbers, but he did have at least one occasion where the situation was really rather desperate. The boat was icing up. He and his friend, Australian friend Kate, they had left New England too late in the year, and they got caught in a winter gale off the coast of New Jersey, and it blew very hard and very cold, and the spray was collecting in ice all over the boat, and they did get hit by one gust that knocked the boat down, that is, mast and sails in the water, and now sticking straight up in the air, was not only the outrigger hull itself and the crossbeams, but fastened into the net between the crossbeams, he had two kayaks and a dinghy lashed into the net. All of that windage up there and all of that weight from the thing icing up was very fortunately not enough to cause the boat to turn all the way over turtle fashion with the mast pointing down. Instead, the buoyancy in the pod cranked the boat back on its feet. It came down with a whomp, and if it hadn't, we might not have Russell and Kate today. It was definitely a survival situation. But now I will try to relate that to Russell's new boat. It's not new. It's new to him. He sold his proa a few years ago to a guy who was using it for single-handed racing. And he now has a 32-foot catamaran called a Goujon 32. This is a very unusual catamaran, and the real reason that he and his wife, Ashlyn, wanted this boat instead of the proa is that the 32-foot catamaran is only 8.5 feet wide. That is, its permanent overall beam is 8'6", and that makes it legal on the highway. So they can use the boat, they can keep it in the water when they want to in the summertime, but easily trailer it home, and he doesn't have to worry about it hanging on a mooring all winter, which just drove him nuts with his other boat. And that's really the way yachting is moving these days. Anyone who isn't independently wealthy can really no longer afford to keep a boat in the water these days. That's why trailering has become so popular. Well, Russell's Goujon 32 has a remarkable means of rewriting from a knockdown. It's a system that was worked out by the late great Jan Goujon, who designed this vessel, and he and his brother Mead produced this thing. They produced, I think, 12 of them back in the 1980s, or was it the 90s? I think in the 90s. And this boat has, as part of its standard equipment, a masthead float, a thing called a dirigible. It's about as big as, maybe 2.5 basketballs. but shaped like the Goodyear blimp, and it rotates on a spindle at the masthead so that it's always facing into the wind. It has very little windage and weight, and that masthead float prevents this very narrow catamaran from turning turtle. It's not hard to knock it down, mast and sails in the water, because it's so narrow. But it does not turn turtle because the buoyancy at the masthead keeps it lying there. Let's say the boat's lying on what we call the beam ends, one hull, the side of one hull in the water, the other hull sticking up in the air, and the mast out horizontal, lying on the water, being held up by the dirigible. And Jan worked out this system that makes it possible for one sailor, hardly getting his feet wet, to incline the mast down toward the bottom of the ocean. Well, it won't go because of the masthead float. So instead, the hull, standing on edge of the two hulls, one of them way up in the air, gets cranked back onto its feet. The boat will plop back down with both hulls in the water and the mast sticking out at a great incline out over the side of the vessel. But now, by retrimming the what I call the running shrouds, they call them running backstays, but they're really shrouds that can be trimmed from the cockpit using blocks and tackle and winches if necessary. You can re-erect the mast after the hulls are back on their feet and sail away. Now, Russell's had that happen twice. He capsized it once when he first had the boat in order to actually practice the tactic of rewriting. And he had it happen once by accident with a gear failure. The boat was capsized, and incidentally, it carries water ballast. These hulls have water ballast tanks, which the sailor can fill and evacuate easily using strings in the cockpit to open up scooper ports in the tanks underwater that either scoop water in or suck water out as the boat passes through the water. But this water ballast system, of course, adds weight, and in order to sail the boat well, a sailor is tempted not to add weight. And so you have to really ride the thing. Russell discovered during this recent race to Alaska that it wasn't easy to sail the boat well, that is, without using water ballast to make the thing go as fast as he could keep it going in a race. He didn't capsize it, but he had to ride herd on the boat carefully. Mm. Okay, this relates to Tim Mann's proa. Tim Mann's commercial proa is intended to have a pod on the downwind side and a masthead float, so that a commercial fisherman who is maybe not all that much of a sailor can knock the boat down and get it back on its feet automatically, no mast inclining necessary because of the pod.
Ah.
And so he, at least in his opinion, he has identified the proa configuration as being the safest and probably also the least expensive a sailing fishing boat for an artisanal fishery that he can imagine. And I tend to think he's right. I think the proa has a lot to show us yet, particularly when applied to commercial vessels. And the interesting thing about the proa configuration relative to what's going on in my life right now is that this hybrid wing that's being developed up in Rhode Island is an ideal rig for the proa, because it would be very easy to shunt a proa with the hybrid wing, because the hybrid wing can rotate 360 degrees, take the wind from any angle, And even if the proa were to get caught aback, that is, with the wind coming from the wrong side, the wing can be weather vaned into the wind so as not to apply healing effort on the boat at that time. And by carefully trimming the wing, one could sail the boat back onto its proper point of sail with the wind coming over the outrigger side instead. But for reasons that I could go on and on about, the hybrid wing is an ideal rig, I think, an ideal rig for the shunting proa. And these things have yet to all come together. The hybrid wing is such a new thing. It's still in the expensive research phase of development. But I personally see a great potential for applying this boat to, well, retrofitting it onto any a recreational multi-hull, and also applying it to these artisanal vessels, fishing boats or crabbing boats, whatever it is that you want to do, in order to exercise this freedom that Tim still has in his mind. Ever since he was a high school kid, he's thought that the greatest freedom available to an individual on this planet would be to have his own boat with which he could sustain himself and go anywhere, particularly anywhere in the warm water areas of the world, and catch enough fish to earn himself enough money to keep going. And he intends now to start building this 37-foot half-size model. It would be the right size for the tuna squid fishery, but going from there to a 75-foot proa, which is certainly approachable with the same constant camber construction method and the same equipment that he's put in there on the Big Island, he would intend to go into a much longer range fishery, with being able to carry a lot more fish and produce his own ice on board and so on. So what I'm trying to do here, Joe, is to explain to our listeners that there is a certain integration in what's happening. Because I've been looking at the multi-hull issue for so long, I'd like to try to, you know, get the big picture, bring it all together. And as I see it, this this junket that I am making starting tonight, I've got an all-night red-eye on the train to get from Williamsburg, Virginia, up to Providence, Rhode Island, where I'll hook up with Scott Brown and his wife, Mary Beth, and we're going to go take some pictures of the fast-forward composites boat, a 40-foot catamaran that has a new 62-foot rigid wing, hybrid wing sail on it. And so when I come back next week, I'm hoping to have the story for you folks as to just what we learned, what we saw. And I'll tell you more about the wing and how it might integrate into the sailing world on a commercial level. I hope it'll be good news. There's no guarantee, as Randy Smythe says, and he's the real co-progenitor of the hybrid wing. Randy Smythe says, you never know what you're going to learn. And they're bound to learn something every time they go sailing with this thing. And this is one of the first rides, and we get to go on that on Wednesday. I hope I'll be able to let you know about it next week.